Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup. An hour spent discovering the arts in Cambridge and talking to the talented people making creative things happen all over the city. In this edition, we meet Aidan and Bet's artists as they forge a link with the city's north and begin a temporary residence at Kettle's Yard, and director Andrew Noone talks on developing closer ties with people across the city. Storyteller Robert Lloyd Parry previews an evening of chilling ghost stories by Montague Rhodes James at the Leper Chapel. White House Arts Caroline Amory talks about the key to discovering your inner talents with art and craft courses that bring you out of your shell in an idyllic riverside setting. And Anglia Ruskin University's Dr. Andy Salmon previews the cutting-edge visual design conference Vivid starting next week, which offers young people the promise of an exciting new career in visual language. Weekend evening events at Kettle's Yard bounced back into action last weekend as a new temporary residency turned over the exhibition space to the intelligent ravages of Aidan Abett, whose artists delighted audiences with a new exhibition and live performance, demonstrating again a growing public appetite for action-packed art-led evenings. Director Andrew Noone welcomed an enthusiastic turnout at the show.
We're really thrilled with the exhibition, and we're really thrilled with what Aidan and Bet have pulled off here. And I would like to just start by thanking our artists in the exhibition. So that's Martin Cross, Rosanna Greaves, Kevin Hunt, Richard Prophet, Sean Vickery, and Lisa Wilkins. And I think it's some really wonderful work, and I hope you'll come back and explore it more carefully. There's a kind of theme, as you will have spotted, rather feels right for this strange time of the year of the kind of the uncanny. Come back and have a proper look, because it's a bit crowded to see tonight. How has this all come about? Well, there's a blue plaque out here to Jim Eade, great founder of Kettle's Yard, and it says, a friend to artists. And recently through our archive, which we've been really getting to know, which is the 10 letters a day or more that Jim Eade wrote pretty much the whole of the cultural world of the 20th century, it's clear that he didn't just support Ben Nicholson and Gaudia Breschke, he supported artists all his life, and very quietly and in lots of different ways. And I'd like to think that here at Kettle's Yard we're still friends to artists, and artists are at the heart of what we do. And Cambridge has many practicing artists of all kinds, and Aidan and Bet, based down at the station, are one of our liveliest group of artists, and they've done a brilliant job. And I'd particularly like to thank CJ Marnie, Sarah Evans and David Kefford, who have actually created all of this, and indeed the programme. So thank them. It's a slightly nervous thing for us to kind of go, would you like to kind of take over, you know, what does that really look like? But they've been absolutely brilliant to work with. They've done a brilliant job. They've sort of said no when it was a good idea to tell us no, and they've said yes when we didn't think they were going to say yes. And I think they've done a brilliant job. And coming soon after them is Outpost up in Norwich, the other great artist-led space in these parts. So I hope you'll come back for that too.
Characteristically, Aidan and Bet, who run an art space in the city's south near the railway station, invited artists from far afield to participate, with sculpture, film, print and a live performance, which focus on elements of the outsider, the cult and the uncanny. Artist Richard Prophet experiments with punk subculture and post-apocalyptic ideas, and produced a large rusty derelict motor scooter adorned with an animal fur seat. He explained what the structure was about. Richard, how did you end up being in Kettle's Yard with Aidan Abett this evening?
I received an email about 3 months ago just asking if I wanted to exhibit work in a show that they were curating. Gave me a kind of brief outline of the basic kind of gist of the ideas and themes that they were going for. So
now, you don't actually live even in England, do you? You live in Dublin.
I do, that's right.
Yeah, and you're from Liverpool originally.
I'm from Liverpool and I live in Dublin now, yeah.
It's very much an Aidan Abett thing, isn't it, to be able to sort of network with artists from lots of other art spaces and bring them to Cambridge to do things like that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what it should be about, you know, because it's great being able to meet other people who are kind of like-minded in the way they go about making work or the things they're interested in, and places, especially for like Cambridge.
Now you put a piece here in the middle of the gallery here at Kettle's Yard. It's what used to be a motorbike. Where did the idea come to produce that piece?
Well, the work was originally made for a show called Global Studio at the Blue Coat in Liverpool, yeah. And It was made with the intention of trying to connect the ideas that are global and local at the same time. So the initial found object is a moped, which was found in the outskirts of Liverpool and was then adorned with these found objects that kind of transform it from being something local to being something that we might associate with the Wild West or the deserts of America or Australia or, you know, post-apocalyptic fiction. So
it's a wonderfully rusty core of a moped with a furry seat on it and things projecting from the back of it. Do you just love the aesthetics of things that are being thrown away like that? Is that something that interests you?
I like things when they have a bit of history attached to them. I mean, some of the objects that are used on it don't have that history until you attach it to it by putting it on the piece. Like the fur that is on the seat was bought brand new, but once it's placed on something with so much history, it kind of, that history becomes attached to that, and it becomes this kind of relic in a way, you know.
Do you like discarded and overlooked things and things that come from wastelands? Is that something that interests you as an artist?
Kind of landscapes that I'm drawn to, you know, wastelands, deserts, docklands, any kind of area has that kind of, you know, it just sparks the imagination for me. Kind of like to do more of that, really.
And as a group of artists for this exhibition, are you firing off ideas from each other? I mean, how do you kind of work together? What's the group dynamic like at all?
Well, I think that's been up to the curators. There's some artists in the show that I was familiar with the work of those artists before I came to Cambridge for this, but it's really been down to the curators and how they've made the work kind of work together from room to room and then as a whole exhibition on its own. For example, there's connections between the symbolism in Martin Cross's collages and the symbolism in my sculptures, you know, and then the similarities in form and shape between other pieces of work in the show and kind of the landscapes in Sean Vickery's work and kind of landscapes that I'm influenced by. It's all connected in kind of subtle ways that I think make it interesting.
So obviously delighted you came to the audience. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Ian Paxson's performance, Prince Volume, an offshoot yarn in words, pictures and sound, broke all the rules of narrative in a highly entertaining way, with projector images in charcoal prompting off-the-cuff story improvisation to music. Here's an extract.
Prince Volume left the valley and rode north atop his sturdy horse Clop. Through forest and moorland, they eventually reached the edge of the known territory and the beginning of the rough, steep track that would take them into the mountains. He had dreamt of a mountain palace lying high up on the peaks and could hold back no longer. His vision of the palace glistening bright with jewels was so vivid he was convinced it must be real. For though a prince by name, Prince Volume lived a peasant's life in a humble shack amongst the people of the wooded valley. "Prince, where's your palace?" was a question that had buried deep inside his doubtful mind and plagued him constantly. With no family to show him his way home, it was up to him to find his place. "Where is my palace?" he would ask himself. Dreams had given him the clues. High up, somewhere in the mountains. But only by searching would it be found. He looked ahead at the track that twisted sharply around the rocks. Clop snorted, his breath hanging in the cold air like a mist, and off they went. Keep on the inside. love you. Up in front of you. Let's go carefully. Don't slip, keep your hooves quick, but stick to the path. The sun's going down. Keep your eyes to the ground. Let the last remaining light guide us to our camp before the black fills the land and the sun waves its hand. Prince Volume spotted a clearing to the side of the path. Here, he said. He took off Klopp's saddle. Klopp lay on the short, dry grass. The prince dragged over a fallen tree and made a fire. He sat and looked out over the edge of the rock and into the blue abyss as the dark pushed the sun down under the horizon, and one by one the stars became visible again. Sleep came easily.
Other artists for the residency linking the city's north and south art worlds are Martine Cross, Annabelle Dover, Rosanna Greaves, Kevin Hunt, Sean Vickery and Lisa Wilkins. Kettleshire director Andrew Nairns says that he decided to do something bold with the space at this point in time.
I met David Kefford, who's one of the three artists who runs Aidenabet, which is in a sort of warehouse down by Cambridge Station, maybe about 7 or 8 months ago. And at the same time, I was thinking about Jim Eade, who founded Kettle's Yard, and who was a great friend to artists. And I was trying to think, how can we really express the fact that Kettle's Yard is not simply a collection, a very beautiful and special collection, of work by artists who are dead, but actually a living, live place that shows contemporary art. And I particularly wanted to connect again with contemporary artists in Cambridge, people working now, being creative. And Aidenabet are an exciting, relatively new organisation, and we thought it'd be wonderful to let them take over.
Now, Jim Eade set something very special in motion. It sounds as though you're trying to keep that special thing going throughout what's happening in Kettle's Yard. Now, you've actually, as a relatively new director, taken on from Michael Harrison, who was credited for doubling the audience and the interest of the yard. But you're actually returning to somewhere where you started your career in the arts, aren't you?
Yes, actually my first job was at Kettle's Yard in the dark days of the 1980s. And it was the same place but different place. And then I went on and worked in Birmingham and in Scotland for many years, and then most recently in Oxford and in London. So I've been all over the place. But it means that I certainly sort of know the collection well. I just felt very excited being back in Cambridge. It was a long time ago, being part of the university, but also part of this community. I think Aidenabet wants to be part of the community. And by bringing them to the north of Cambridge, they're down in the south at the station, it just feels like an exciting thing to do. And we took a risk. We didn't know which artists they would choose. We let them curate the exhibition. If you're listening to this, you should absolutely come and see the show, because you'll see some very intriguing contemporary art.
Now, Jim Eade's story was basically, he was a director at the Tate Gallery, wasn't he? And he made this fantastic collection of art. But then he, late in his life, turned it all over to create this wonderful space, didn't he? And you know that whole story, don't you?
It's rather an extraordinary story. He was an assistant curator at the Tate in the 1920s and 30s. Arguably, he was essentially like the first modern art curator. I think the director there was really struggling with Monet and Van Gogh in the 1920s. And of course, Jim was already friends with Ben Nicholson, who's a famous British abstract painter making abstract paintings. So Jim actually found it pretty difficult being at the Tate. He left the Tate. He used to give lecture tours in America. He lived in Morocco. He lived in France. And in the meantime, artists gave him works of art. He bought a few works of art. And he always intended
for these to become the property of the public, for these to effectively belong to everyone. And he went to school in Cambridge, actually, at the Lees School, you know, before the First World War. And so he had an affection for Cambridge, and so he looked for somewhere in Cambridge where he could display this extraordinary objects, and not just objects. Anyone who's been at Kettle Hill will know lovely furniture, carpets, you can sit on all the chairs. It's a very special, it's like a house.
But there are classic pieces of art here as well, obviously by Henry Moore, by Miro, by Barbara Hepworth, really fantastically valuable things to discover at all of those places in the house. Not everybody knows all about that. I mean, I heard that Peter Blake was in Cambridge recently, and he said that he'd never actually been here before, but he specifically wanted to come to Kettle's Yard to discover it, and was absolutely amazed at what's really here. And that kind of the growing knowledge of what's happening here and the popularity is creating a very exciting arts hub here. And now you've taken over that whole situation. What is it that you want to do in future? You've got Aidan Abett here. You're bringing in Outpost, I gather, from Norwich as well. You're generating with the new educational space a kind of new feel, a new direction to the gallery?
Yes, I think the house and the collection are the heart of Kettle's Yard. They opened in 1957. We feel strongly we've raised the money to build an education wing. It's actually sort of vertical, but it's a wing. We also think the galleries need some love and attention. They haven't been touched for nearly 20 years. And so we're looking at a building project, perhaps in 2015-16, which would really transform all the spaces, if you like, for the artists, for the contemporary galleries, the changing exhibition spaces, but also for visitors, and really bring us up to scratch in comparison with other places around the country. And that seems important because the quality of what we have in the collection, being part of Cambridge University, one of the great universities in the world, means why wouldn't we want to be totally world class when it comes to the exhibitions? The Aidan Abett and Outpost exhibitions are a wonderful sense of kind of energy about young artists and artists working in Cambridge and in the region, and we want to support that. Kettle's Yard needs to be a place that supports artists and supports modern and contemporary art.
And what we've got with Aidan Abett is we've got this wonderful motorbike sculpture, hoops, films, yep, various things like that. We're basically, they're dealing with elements of the outsider, the cult, the uncanny, and punk culture and post-apocalyptic ideas. Why do people at the moment seem to keep coming back to punk as a source of inspiration for things like that?
I think it's odd. It's at a moment when digital technology is completely taking off, and increasingly we can see how it's useful in our lives and even sort of extraordinary and remarkable. At exactly that same moment, we're looking for authenticity. This is why music festivals are so successful around the country. This is why so many people go to our galleries and museums. They want an authentic, one-to-one, kind of physical experience with art. This wonderful motorbike, which does look as though it's come off the set of Mad Max 2, I'd say, or possibly Mad Max 3, looks as though it's sort of been driven into the gallery, is one of, as you say, a number of works which seem to be dealing with the kind of uncanny and the strange. It's a very well curated exhibition, and all credit to David and CJ and Aidan Abett for inviting these particular artists.
Now, as well as opening all of that to show the public, you had Ian Paxton doing this highly entertaining performance, which everybody loved. How did he get involved in it all?
Well, it's another invitation from David. We had no idea. But since you mentioned punk, I mean, I think people feel that punk has a kind of authenticity about it. It blew the cobwebs away on I mean, it's funny because actually I think most of us can like both, but groups like the Eagles suddenly were made to look as though they were completely irrelevant in the context of punk. I think we can all quite like the Eagles again now. But I think what I liked about Ian Paxton's work was sometimes his voice had almost a kind of punk quality about it when he was kind of singing. And that's very unusual because we have concerts in the house at Kettle's Yard, but they are classical concerts of Haydn and Mozart and Bach. Mm. And actually it was rather refreshing to have this, as you say, rather...
It's breaking the rules of giving a narrative by including everything into it.
And he didn't seem to be too worried whether his voice sort of hit the notes sometimes.
Right, so I mean, you're using lottery funding to create the new education wing and so on and so forth. forth. Now, in the past, you've done work with the Icon Gallery in Birmingham, the Centre of Contemporary Arts in Glasgow, and with the Arts Council, another prestigious council such as Modern Art in Oxford. One of your great concepts, as far as I've read your bio, is achieving great art for everyone.
Well, this is the Arts Council's
slogan. And that's going to be an important part of what happens in future years.
Absolutely, and we feel we're absolutely passionate. The education wing, when it is built, potentially as part of a bigger project in 2016, will of course enable us to do more. But it isn't just about what we do at Kettle's Yard, in Castle Street, in the Castle Hill area, behind the Folk Museum. It isn't just about what we do here, it's about what we do in other parts of the city and in other ways. And we would like to work in North Cambridge, particularly perhaps in Arbury and in King's Hedges, and begin a kind of programme of working with local communities, particularly communities who don't, through their education or through their own background, are not natural, if you like, visitors to museums. And we want to introduce them to modern and contemporary art, and indeed to the other seven University of Cambridge museums, and just say, actually, these are astonishing, these objects, these paintings, these artifacts that belong to the university. All of these museums are free. Kettle's Yard is free. You will get so much from learning a little bit about where this painting came from, why Miro was painting this particular blue colour, because it was Catalan background, which is bustling, north of Spain. And there are just tremendous stories, and those stories of art enrich your life, enrich the way you see the rest of the world. And I'm very conscious, or we're very conscious, that not everybody has the opportunity to engage with modern and contemporary art and get much from it.
You need to complete the projects that you've planned at the moment, something like £8 million to get that together. Is philanthropy going to be important for realising the plans?
Yes, and we have already raised a great deal of money, and thank you very much to those who have been so generous for the education wing. So we already have £3.7 million towards our education wing. We will now hold on to that money, and we will hopefully join it up with some more money and do a bigger project that transforms the exhibition spaces. For those who know Kettle's Yard, they will understand that the exhibition spaces really are a little bit tired now, and we can make them beautiful again. And they need to be beautiful, because the Kettle's Yard house and collection is beautiful. And really my job is to say, why can't it all be beautiful, and how can we make that happen? But while building projects always make people a little bit nervous, we will still be doing lots of activity over the next few years, on-site, off-site, and in collaboration with wonderful organisations like Aidan and Barrett.
Andrew Nairn, thank you very much indeed for sparing some time to talk to Cambridge 105. Most interesting, thank you.
Thank you.
Dark nights, rising mists and cold weather conditions can often play tricks with the mind, especially when you're alone and perhaps in an old building at night. It's the season for huddling around and telling yarns, and Cambridge is certainly rich in the ghost story genre. I've been talking to storyteller Robert Lloyd Parry, who's recounting the stories of Cambridge legend Montague Rhodes James, a past master of the classic ghost story. He's performing on the 24th, 25th and 26th of January at the Leper Chapel in Newmarket Road. Robert, how did you become introduced to the world of M.R. James? It was through your work, wasn't it?
Well, initially I was introduced to it by my dad when I was about 13 years old, giving me a copy of his ghost stories, and I remember really loving them then. Much later on in life, kind of when I was about 30, I got a job at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. That's kind of what brought me to Cambridge in the first place. And it was when I was there that I discovered that M.R. James had been the director of the museum around about 1900, around exactly the time that he was writing his earliest ghost stories. And so this kind of revived my childhood excitement. I had the opportunity to perform. I always felt that the stories were just ready to performance, that they needed and would work best performed out loud. And I got the chance to perform in what, in fact, really was M.R. James's office when he ran the museum, the Founders Library in the Fitzwilliam. And that was back in 2005, and I've kind of...
Do things ever go bump in the night at the Fitzwilliam when you're working late there? Because it can be quite a spooky place with all of those things like knights, armour and...
Statues in shadow are always going to be a bit spooky.
Yeah. And floorboards presumably squeak and groan. And
I think any old building at night is, you know, it can... prick the imagination.
And it's amazing actually saying that, because you've given this wonderful provenance to your storytelling, because there his spirit is almost standing behind you from the Fitzwilliam saying continue this work.
You know, I did allow myself to imagine when I was first performing in his office that, you know, Is there someone else sitting on the back row who I can't quite see in the shadows? And
There are lots of different types of ghost stories, obviously. Some of them have that stood the test of time kind of historical provenance, which makes them stronger as ghost stories. And obviously, some are less light-hearted and some are more kind of almost frightening. What kind of stories are these that you're going to be telling?
These are ghost stories written by Montague Rhodes James, who is generally, and I think rightly, credited as being the writer of the best ghost stories in the English language. His first volume of them was published in 1904. That consists of seven stories that were mainly written in the 1890s and early 1900s to read aloud to his friends in King's College, Cambridge, of a Christmas Eve. Now, the first two stories, in fact, were presented on the 28th of October, 1893. Now, whether that was deliberately close to Halloween or not, I don't know. I'm just not sure how much Halloween was marked in the way it is today. But they are winter's tales, deliberately winter's tales. They are to be experienced in a darkened room with a few friends, with a glass of wine by the fire. And it's that kind of atmosphere that I try to recreate in my performances. So they're classic English literary ghost stories.
Now, the Leper Chapel is something like, is it 13th century or even earlier than
12th
that?
Century.
12th century. And it's exactly the kind of place that one would expect in a timeless zone on a misty evening to run into the Green Knight or something like that and have a supernatural experience. So it's a great setting to do something like that, isn't it?
It is. It really is a marvellous old building and kind of, you know, a kind of hidden treasure of Cambridge. I guess it's disadvantaged by being in a rather unpromising sort of area just off Newmarket Road, kind of opposite Halfords and opposite the football stadium and so on. But it's really worth a visit.
When I was younger, we often used to gather in winter as kids and tell ghost stories. And sometimes we frighten the lives out of each other because, you know, that they have a particular quality to them, don't they? When they get into a part of the psyche that's always been with us, and it gives you that chill and that fright if it's a good one, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, M.R. James, he talks about, he says that he tries to evoke what he calls a pleasing terror. So, it's a mixture of great enjoyment, but actual terror as well. He does not hold back from the kind of visceral horrors, particularly in these two stories that I'm doing in the Leper Chapel.
Can you give me any clues as to some of the things that happen in these stories?
Well, I mean, his great talent is, you know, what he's fated for is the kind of the slow build-up of tension. People always say of him, it's what you don't see is almost as effective and terrifying as what you do see. And that's absolutely true. He was a master of timing. He was kind of, you know, the timing of a great comedian, but kind of sent in a different direction to kind of, you know, cause tension and fear rather than mirth, although he's a very funny man as well. So even though that's true, the climax of many of his stories is viscerally horrible. You know, people do experience the utmost horrors. I don't want to reveal too much.
It's a genre, obviously, that interested Shakespeare greatly, with Hamlet's spooky apparitions, things that happen in the half-light between dreaming and waking, and people are not quite sure whether or not they're real. They're definitely frightening when you look at the open door of the cupboard at night when you're a child. I mean, I can remember being in a house in Cornwall, which was Folly. It's one of these houses that had more windows on the outside than you could find rooms on the inside, and that's because it had two hidden rooms in it.
Oh, right. Okay.
One of them was a secret priest hole, and the other one was a round room. And a round room used to be a place which was supposed to be somehow, in Cornish kind of mystery, a way of defending your household from spooky spirits at night. Plus, at night, the electricity didn't seem to work, which meant that you had to go round this house with candles and things like that, freezing cold, dark in the winter, as a child. And that can be quite an exhilarating thing as well as a frightening thing, can't it?
That's right. It is a sense of excitement and thrill as well as... Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now the Leper Chapel is going to be... what time does it kick off on the 24th?
7:30.
7:30. And how many people can participate?
It accommodates 60.
60. And will that be candlelit or something like that?
Yes.
It'll be candlelit in the Leper Chapel.
Yes. It'll be very dark and pretty cold.
Reaching your inner self through art is something many people dream of, but it takes a conscious decision to make that connection a reality, and it's by no means easy to find the right help. I've been hearing the remarkable story of a centre created by an artist who, when left living alone with a beautiful riverside family home and gardens, decided to take the radical decision to open it up and share it as an arts centre offering arts and craft courses. White House Arts, a non-profit-making charity, is in an idyllic setting on the edge of the River Cam at Starbridge Common, graced by passing rowing aids, and has a unique story behind how it came to be. Director Caroline Amory spent many years as a social worker helping troubled adolescents and young children in regional paediatric wards, and found that when she encountered communication problems, often art activity was the key to gently reaching children and unlocking hearts through self-expression. Her own fine art degree changed her life, and she decided to create an active process to do the same for others. She now shares the management of the project with Gladys James, another former teacher.
How does it feel to you, having turned your life over to this completely? I mean, was it a very big decision in your life, and has it changed it?
It's extraordinary when I think back, because I used to be a social worker and I was very focused outside the house on things that were very sad and often rather impoverished. And I think this has given me a tremendous feeling for the potential in everybody. Mm-hmm. I do get a tremendous kick out of people's pleasure coming here. Mm. It's quite hard work, but it really doesn't feel like it, because there's a great deal of pleasure to be seen every day. And I feel people take away skills and confidence that they can use in whatever walk of life they're in. Mm. And I suppose one of my other great thrills is a group that's sort of seeded itself from here, that learnt here and went away and now meet weekly to do their own drawing, and that really pleases me, when people take the ideas, go away and use it in their own environments and carry on the adventure. Well, White House Arts began because basically my husband, who had started to run his business in an extension to our house, his business grew too big and he moved out, leaving this lovely space. Yeah. And so two young friends, Rachel Merrington and Rachel Dormer, a sculptor and a potter, asked me if they could come and use the space. They'd just come out of college, which obviously I was a good idea, but I thought it might be a good idea at that point, if they had the energy, to help me start an art centre that could be shared. And so they did this with great alacrity, and it started at very low key with very few courses per week, and gradually it has built up with admin help and a lot of expertise coming in to help me. Then it has grown to be the business now, which it is, with a charity that it now is, which basically runs with about three or four courses a day and weekend courses as well. So we run to capacity now. But the same impulse is behind every course, which is it's fun, it's a lovely place to be, and we welcome people who want to come and try out new skills.
Cambridge is full of places to discover artistically, and this is very much somewhere where people can discover their talents and find out about them.
It certainly is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of our raison d'etre. Mm-hmm. We like to encourage people who are perhaps shy of their own skills, or perhaps have overlooked them over the years and want to try something new. It's certainly, there are no hoops to jump here. It's a recreational courses we run, but we do have, every tutor is a practicing artist. Every tutor is very clear about the ethos here, which is to welcome people at whatever level they are, and that means complete beginners. And it also means people who are already exhibiting artists who perhaps want to go in different directions or just work in company and get new ideas and inspirations from others.
Can you tell me a little bit about the facilities that are available here and the range of courses that you offer?
Well, basically the art centre is a very large room in which there is a sink and there are six pottery wheels, a lot of jewellery equipment and a lot of equipment for artists wanting to work in 2D and mixed media and painting and so on. We have tables enough for groups of about 12. We never go up more than 12. Very often it's 10 or less. So that's small groups, and basically we work with ceramics, silversmithing or jewellery making, and painting and drawing. Those are the main three basic courses that we run. But on top of that, we have a number of other courses, including sculpture or portrait painting, all sorts of things. Like, there's a specialist coming in doing very, very exact drawing of from botanical or still life using just coloured pencils. It's a very particular way of approaching still lives. And there's any number of different courses that we do at weekends and so on. This year we're having, for the first time, an exhibition in the middle of July here, probably using a marquee as well because we've got so many keen exhibitors, exhibiting students' work and tutors' work right across the board, so any discipline. And that is a first for us because we have in the past had tutors exhibiting, but this time got such a body of students who are confident and wanting to exhibit that we've decided to do it this year.
Do you have any tales of wonderful things that have happened here that we might talk about?
As I say, we do encourage people to come from with very little art background at all. And it comes to mind that there's somebody came paid for by their company who was a pilot and was quite stressed at work. And she came along and on that occasion she was doing weaving, basket weaving. And she got herself into such excitement about it that she went and took a day off her work and went down to do a City and Guilds down in London. And then she has become an exhibitor of her baskets. And in addition, she's did a knitting course with us and now runs her own knitting business. So she dramatically turned her life around through this centre.
Caroline took me for a tour of the beautiful gardens and outhouses, which are filled with pottery kilns and bulging with arts materials and resources. I encountered a striking sculpture caricature of a giant orange tabby cat, amongst other wonderful things, and found a world designed to release whatever idea you might have. White House Art's lively teaching studio bustles with students engaged in mixed media work and printmaking, and offers resources and expert tutoring for a wide range of courses.
But there's another element, which is obviously that you're also raising money for charity.
Yes. Well, we have become a charity. Yeah, yeah. We've always been non-profit making, but we've since, in the last 2 years, we've formalised ourselves and we've become a charity, so that we do now, where we are, 2 years ago, we raised a lot of money through an exhibition, which I think about 300 people contributed to, for SOS Children's Villages. We raised about £11,500 over a weekend. And how we did it was we got people to buy a canvas for £10, which was the hanging fee and the entrance fee, so to speak. And then they were able to make their picture, or if they were a jeweller or a ceramicist, somehow incorporate their skills into that one 12-inch square. And every work of art was sold for £45, flat rate. So we had some extremely experienced artists and some beginners, some children, and I think the age range went from 18 months up to 92. And we sold a tremendous amount, and there was some excellent artwork there. And we're doing that again this November at Chesterton Community College, and we will obviously be advertising that in due course. Because of our setting, we do go out quite a bit, but the drawing people do use the garden and the river. We have got a river trip when one of our tutors takes us up the river, and that is very, very popular in the summer, you know, going out for the whole day and drawing and painting on the way. And so we are very blessed in our environment, and obviously, you know, the natural world comes in a lot and gets drawn a lot, and we have a lot of space to do you know, the occasional raku firing or smoke firing outside. So we're very lucky in the space. There's plenty of place to park, so it's not too much of a hassle about, you know, taking your precious artwork back into your car and home again. You can just sort of slip it into the back seat and go. And no, I think my main excitement about it is the skills of our tutors and the enthusiasm and their creativity is really makes the place. The environment is lovely too, and so together that forms what I've sort of dreamt about.
If you're young and imaginative and looking for a piping hot potato in terms of a future lucrative career, you really should be signed in for the international conference at Anglia Ruskin University next week, showcasing the cutting-edge world of visual design. Creative Front and Anglia Ruskin have invited a panel of expert speakers from across the world who'll focus on three visual design industry themes of economic benefits and stimulating business growth, enhancing business with design, and visual design innovation. Dr. Andy Salmon, Deputy of the Arts, Law and Sciences Faculty, introduces a field that Ruskin is currently running interrelated courses in.
This visual design conference is very much something for young people, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's a new area that has a real future in it, and that's really the attraction of it, isn't it?
I think that's exactly the attraction. Design is not just about traditional art forms. Obviously, it includes things like games, but it is also increasingly including how we apply new technologies and design to a whole host of things which originally would not have been thought of in that way in the slightest.
Can you tell me a little bit about Creative Front as an organisation and why they've teamed up with Anglia Ruskin University?
Sure. Creative Front arose out of Anglia Ruskin as a broker, really, between creative businesses and the university, art school and related courses.
Can you tell me a bit about the kind of things that are going to be covered during this course, this set of seminars and workshops?
Yes, an amazing array of things. Vivid is nine North European partners from Northern France, Belgium, Holland and the south coast of the UK. Incredible range of applications. So, for instance, on the one hand, animations, on the other hand, applied programs for science, the Boeing Corporation, on the other hand, how games can be used to be teaching people in medical schools. The possibilities, in fact, are almost endless, as well as talks from key industry leaders, such as the main thing in the workshops is that they are talking about what they do. The Thursday conference is a series of short workshops where people are actually talking about their passions, their research, their applied knowledge. So in each case, it'll be a case of talking through their areas of expertise, and from there, the audience being able to, I think, to get a sense of the array of different activities.
Is it very much about new approaches to common problems? Because that's what design does, doesn't it?
Yes.
It takes a problem and it turns it around on its head and produces a new innovation that basically freshens it all up. It brings something alive to the people who are going to consume it. It's that kind of creativity that you're trying to unlock here, isn't it?
I think it is. I think the title of Vivid means, it's an acronym, it means value increased by visual design. The whole idea behind that is that visual design, in other words, how you design something, how you make it look, in a visual culture, enables people to access information and understanding, which in other ways just would remain locked.
And that's very much tied up in psychology and understanding human psychology,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah. And obviously that has enormous potential benefits economically for companies and the people who do it as well. And it's one of those areas that shows real promise for the future. It can lead to highly lucrative careers. So it's something that I think is very exciting for young people, isn't it?
It's hugely exciting. And something which in the UK is very undersold. The UK remains the second most productive creative industries network in the world. £1 in £12 in the UK is a creative industries pound. But the future is about connectivity with other partners in other parts of the world, and particularly in this kind of Northern European hub, there's obviously a concentration. So very, very important, I think, for young people, for our students, to understand where these possibilities exist and to begin to get their heads around life in a sort of multinational environment.
Britain is famous for that, and Cambridge, for coming up with brilliant ideas, but then not being the ones who cash in on the rewards.
Yeah,
isn't that it? Because we do love to do the thinking and the creativity part, but it's joining it up with the the real economic benefits that turns out to be quite difficult, wouldn't you say?
I think this, and this is what this project is really all about. It is aimed at getting people into employment. The creative front side of it is about business incubation for creatives, starting how you get from that agonised finish my degree, have loads of brilliant ideas. How do I get to work in a sector which has no clear job routes? That's the thread, and that I think is actually the kind of the core answer to your question, in the sense that what we need to work on as a culture is that whole thing about how we create the idea at every level. It's about making knowledge, technology accessible, and that's actually where design comes in. Hmm. And it's a thread between the very different presentations and events we've got on. It is all about how you unlock that clear sense of making something accessible, understandable. And that's about how it's designed.
But we also want things to be increasingly slick, increasingly visually attractive, and increasingly chic, don't we? We want to have visual design that always looks new and cutting edge and the latest thing, because that's moving forward very fast, isn't it, in the real world?
And I think that's a very good question, because I think it seems to me that, you know, the phrase visually literate means something. Hmm. And we are increasingly a visually literate culture, in a way that actually 4 centuries ago we were a verbally literate culture. And I think, you know, that's the interface you're talking about, and this whole project is about.
It's almost a new language.
Yeah.
Yes. Can you tell me about the profile of the things that will be happening during the course, which starts on the 24th of January, doesn't it?
The conference starts on the 24th of January.
Yeah.
The profile is international. We have. With a whole range of things, we have, you know, highly acclaimed academics, some of the ones you mentioned already. We also have, for instance, key talks from a company based, a huge multinational company called Qualcomm, but their research laboratory is based in Cambridge. Their key design is the question about the relationships between visual usability for handset technologies. So it's exactly on what you're asking.
How does Anglia Ruskin see itself as a place which is, like Cambridge University has been in the high-tech industry, as a platform for starting off people's careers in this kind of arena?
Really, really, really important for us.
Hmm.
We're a vocational university in terms of both in the arts and in the sciences, and Vivid crosses over both of them. The whole point of what we do is how to use that technology in a way that enables people to start things that are cutting edge but practical. I think everything is about, like a lot of your questions, everything is about practical application.
Becoming very popular in Cambridge nowadays to have these kind of brainstorming idea sessions on a specific thing. I mean, obviously you have the Festival of Ideas, which has lots of different things,
yeah.
but that's becoming very much a very Cambridge thing to do, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To get in the experts, to let people ask them questions, to explore a new field and generate that kind of positive excitement and imagination.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the great things. So I've only been working in Cambridge 3 years. It's one of the things that I've really relished in terms of being here is precisely that, you know, whether it's I've been involved in ones in like Vivid in relation to design, also in ones in relation to urban planning, also in conversations about, you know, how do we structure the arts offer across the city. Seems to me to be an extraordinarily vibrant city in exactly those regards, which is magnificent.
It's time to take a look at some upcoming events in the Cambridge area. A retrospective exhibition on the life and works of artist Fred Dubry at Clare Hall Gallery in Herschel Road starts on January the 24th and runs till February the 28th. Dubry was known as the painter's painter by his contemporaries and was an intimist painter and colourist in the tradition of Chardin, Vuillard and Bonnard. His career spanned 1926 to 2011, a former student of the Royal College of Art and a celebrated lecturer and writer. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra returns to the Corn Exchange on January the 24th to present romantic masterpieces conducted by Fabian Gabel and featuring soloist Janina Fiakowska, who will play works by Chopin, Brahms and Beethoven, among others. Williams Art has opened a new exhibition in partnership with the Headway Brain Injury Charity, which celebrates talented work by people who've suffered brain injury. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you enjoyed an hour with Cambridge 105.